You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. Coming up, we'll talk to a child development and psychology expert here in Wisconsin about the role that siblings can play in our development from adolescence to adulthood. Now we're taking a look at the leak of hundreds of what appear to be classified Defense Department documents. Those documents deal with the war in Ukraine, U.S. intelligence on Russia and on American allies, and more. They were leaked over the course of several months on Discord, a social media platform popular with gamers. The FBI today arrested an Air Force National Guard member suspected of leaking the documents. According to sources in the Washington Post and New York Times, the documents were leaked to impress teen members of an online group devoted to guns, video games, and racist memes. There's still a lot of details that are still unclear. We're going to focus on what those leaked documents tell us about the war in Ukraine and the U.S. response and the impact that information could have now that it's public. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What are your thoughts, your reactions to this leak of what appear to be a bunch of classified documents? How do you think this could affect U.S. relationships with allies? What questions do you have? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Ted Gerber is a professor of sociology at UW-Madison and director of the Wisconsin-Russia Project. He's an expert on Russia and post-Soviet states. Ted, welcome back to Central Time.
Thank you. Good to be here.
We're going to be hearing about this investigation into the leaks themselves for a while. I want to focus on the impact they have as you're watching this information emerge. What strikes you as most significant, especially as this information relates to the war going on in Ukraine right now?
Well, it's a good question. There are lots of tidbits that are of interest to those of us who've been following the war closely. But I would say there hasn't been anything that's come out yet, at least, that I think has been hugely surprising or that represents kind of a dramatic new piece of information. So it is certainly troubling to hear that the, you know, for example, that the U.S. government assesses that the war is likely to continue as it has been throughout the remainder of this year. Although, you know, again, it's not terribly surprising. Right. I think a lot of the expert community probably feels the same way. It's also, the extent to which the Ukrainian forces were facing severe or perhaps probably do continue to face severe shortages of certain types of munitions, problems in their air defenses. Those are very troubling to hear. But again, you know, not exactly shocking news.
Right. We see some information related to, the disposition of Ukrainian troops, the armaments, some of the places they are. But apparently, from what's been released so far, not things like, you know, specific plans about the goals of an expected Ukrainian offensive this spring. So from an intelligence perspective, in some ways, it could be worse.
That's right. I think it could be worse. I mean, you know, I would actually agree. I think President Biden, when he said that the most troubling aspect of the leak so far is the leak itself, and I think that's very true. That's not to say that, you know, we shouldn't be concerned about this, because if these documents got out, I mean, it's certainly possible that more significant documents will get out, or perhaps already are out there and just haven't been posted yet. And so I would say that so far, you know, the leak is embarrassing. There's information in there that makes it very awkward for U.S. officials and their dealings with our allies. It does raise issues of potential trustworthiness of U.S. government, statements and so forth. But there's nothing that is deeply upsetting yet. But, you know, the fact that within the Defense Department, these kinds of documents are available to individuals such as the, you know, alleged perpetrator, Mr. Teixeira, a 21-year-old gamer, you know, who was part of the Air National Guard. I mean, it's very troubling, and, you know, it does raise serious concerns about potential future leaks.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Mac is with us in Madison. Mac, hello.
Hey, my question is, how did somebody at this, what appears to be a low-level position, have such access? And it kind of reminds me of the Snowden case. I can't recall how he got access. Is this a simple case of hacking a computer that he might have somehow gained access to?
Mac, thanks for the call. This is a question I assume we don't know the answer to at this point, Ted. It's a question I'm assuming the military and intelligence and members of Congress are already asking about this. One thing I want to focus on with you is something that you said. That's a question U.S. allies are going to be asking. I mean, this is I don't have quite the right words for it. This is the stupidest reason for a major leak of intelligence information I've ever heard of. How much do you worry that U.S. allies are going to look at the U.S. and say, yeah, I don't think I want to cooperate. I'm an intelligence agency in Europe. Do I really want to share information with the U.S. if this can happen?
Well, yes, exactly. That is a concern. But it's a perpetual concern. I mean, your caller just referred to the Snowden case. There have been other leaks before that. So on the one hand, yes, I mean, this gets a lot of media attention, and it certainly is not helpful. And it's certainly, you know, if I were a foreign intelligence organization official or a government official, it certainly would increase my level of concern. But in the real world, these people who are in those positions, they're fully aware of the risks that something like this could happen. It has happened before. And so I think, you know, that it's more like the PR side of things is the most dramatic aspect of the story, at least so far. I want to qualify, at least in terms of what's come out so far. And so I would reiterate that. I mean, you know, in terms of your listener's question, I mean, as you pointed out, we don't know. We'll find out. But I mean, the Department of Defense and the U.S. intelligence operations are vast, and they rely on a lot of different employees, a lot of different workers, and different who are located in different places. And you know, it's always a challenge that a major intelligence organization or collection of organizations, which is what the U.S. intelligence and other governments' intelligence are, when they have to coordinate a lot of different levels of access, a lot of different employees. And so, you know, although it's certainly not good news that these leaks happen, and I do hope that the officials in our government will get to the bottom of what's going on, will take action to prevent this from happening. I think it's also fair to say that this is not a rare event. It happens in other countries. It happens anytime we have classified documents. And it also, to me, points to the role of the information age that we live in, with the rise of information technologies, extreme sophistication of different users, private users, government agencies, and so forth, which sort of has a magnifying effect on, or potential magnifying effect anyway, on these leaks when they do occur.
Talking to Ted Gerber from UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, looking at this leak of classified information, much of it, a lot of it related to Ukraine and Russia. You can join in with your thoughts or questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's go back to your calls. Art is with us in Milwaukee. Art, hi.
Yeah, thanks for taking the call. So they often say that the first casualty in war is the truth. And I looked at the Washington Post summary of this, and indicates two points I got out of it. One, that the internal assessment is that this is a stalemate, and there's no one likely to really win this war decisively in the next year or maybe a couple of years. And secondly, that our State Department is not interested in pursuing negotiations, but basically, as some people say, to fight to the last Ukrainian to combat Russia. And so I think it's sobering when we're asked to send these billions, and the Ukrainians and Russians are both dying in huge numbers, that we get a little bit of the inside story. So thank you.
Art, thanks for the call. Art, I think pointing toward the idea, Ted, that maybe we should be shifting our strategy toward encouraging negotiations between Ukraine and Russia. What might that look like?
Well, that really is indeed the crux of the dilemma that the U.S. government faces. And so the U.S. policy up to this point has been that it's really up to the Ukrainians themselves to decide if and when it is time to negotiate. The Ukrainians have been quite consistent in insisting that the conditions are not met, and that Putin is an unreliable partner to negotiate anyway. And, now while it is true that the U.S. could decide to sort of up the pressure, so that's what those who call for negotiations are saying, that the U.S. should basically compel the Ukrainians to go to the negotiating table by saying that the U.S. will withdraw its support and the support of its allies. I mean, let's face it, you know, really is a coordinated effort at which the United States is at the forefront. And that, therefore, you know, that's how the U.S. could do it. And, you know, I guess I don't, you know, I don't know. First of all, the assessment is an assessment that came out in the leaks, and the assessments have been wrong before. And so, although there's also competing assessments. So within the government, within the various intelligence agencies, different analysts prepare different assessments, and they don't always concur. So there could be other assessments within the government that are different within the U.S. government, that is. But you also have to keep in mind what the stakes are. And so although it does sound the way that actually Putin put it in his speech and that others have put it, that, you know, the U.S. is deciding to fight to the last Ukrainian, it ultimately, in my view, it really is the Ukrainians, because they are bearing the brunt of the casualties and the loss in terms of their lives, but also their economy. You know, if they decide they want to go to the negotiating table, which would involve certainly making concessions to Russia of their territory, then the U.S. is not going to stand in their way. But it doesn't seem like it's really the U.S.'s place to compel them to do so. I think the risk of negotiating at this point anyway outweigh the potential benefits of doing so.
All right. Thanks for the call. I want to talk about that a little more, Ted. As of right now, it appears that Putin would not accept a negotiation without getting some chunks of Ukrainian territory. We see what happens when Russia occupies territory, large-scale murder and war crimes, abduction of children, and the notion that Putin would say, okay, I've got this land and I'm going to stop now. It seems like there's a lot of disincentives for the Ukrainians to embrace that idea of, yeah, we'll give up some of our territory.
I absolutely agree 100%. I think that is the crucial point that those who call for negotiation seem to miss or prefer not to have at the forefront of the discussion. And that is that there really isn't any means to negotiate with a power such as ISS Russia be today, which is really hell-bent on taking over all of Ukraine, on subordinating Ukraine to Russia, on imposing Russian policies, Russian government on Ukraine, and on basically destroying and eliminating Ukrainians as a nation. And I think I'm not exaggerating when I think that is the Russian policy, and any negotiation would only temporarily stave off that policy. So long as Putin is in power, and perhaps it's not just Putin, I actually do think it's mainly Putin, but so long as he is in power, Ukraine will never be safe from the threat of a basically genocidal attack on the part of the Russian state. So one can advocate negotiations, but I think the only way in which that should be, the only way I would support that idea is if negotiations are intended or understood to be coming up with a strategy to buy time so that Russia could be fully defeated in its effort to take over Ukraine. I don't really see that it's up to the United States or Ukraine when this war ends. It's up to Russia. Unless Russia is able to win, the war is going to end when Russia is beaten badly enough that the Russian government has no choice but to cease its operations and withdraw. And I don't think negotiation is going to lead to that. I think you're absolutely right that if negotiation under the current context would require major concessions and all those factors that you discussed, the deportation of children, the extreme Russification policies, those would certainly prevail. And would likely, and Ukraine would remain under danger, whatever is left of Ukraine after the negotiation settlement.
We're talking about the leak of Defense Department documents, including information related to the war in Ukraine. Ted Gerber is with us, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, expert on Russia and post-Soviet states. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your reactions, your questions, your thoughts on what all this means for Russia and Ukraine and the U.S. role there. 800-642-1234 is the number to call. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We're picking up our talk with Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison, an expert on Russia and post-Soviet states, talking about the leak of classified Defense Department documents, including info related to the war in Ukraine, what we're learning about that war in these documents. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Back to your calls. Jed is with us in Le Coudre. Jed, hi.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call.
What did you want to bring up, Jed?
I'm not going to regurgitate the same old talking points. I'm going to very simply and briefly tell you some new ones. Peace now. End all wars. And before he cut me off. You know, there's no winners to war, so it's not a it's a zero sum here. And
gotcha, Jed. Thanks for the call, Ted. I don't know. Easier said than done with an occupying army sitting in a country.
Well, yes. I mean, I certainly, and I'm sure, you know, many listeners share that sentiment that everybody, there's nobody, or I wouldn't say nobody, there are very few people who actually want war, who actually see this as a great opportunity to achieve something. But I have to remind you that, you know, Ukraine did not start this war. The United States did not start this war. And I say that even, you know, now the United States maybe could have had different policies towards Russia. That's arguable, but it's certainly, you know, I certainly reject the idea that anybody started this war except for Russia. So the issue of peace now, that is an issue for Russia to be addressed to Russia. It's Russia who has attacked a sovereign country, and not just attacked, but attacked extremely brutally with major force, including attacks, you know, systematic attacks on civilian populations. So, you know, it's quite easy to say peace now. Yes, we want peace. Everybody wants peace, but it's not the United States that is responsible for this war. I mean, unless you advocate that Ukraine should just fold over and let the Russians take over their country and basically exterminate them as a people. I mean, I don't think that that is something that the U.S. should do or that its allies should do. So I do think it is a good slogan, peace now. It is certainly something everybody hopes for. And I certainly don't think that, you know, there's kinds of pro-military, pro-war, rah-rah patriotism that's driving the U.S. effort to support the Ukrainians in their effort, in, you know, their efforts to stay free from Russian occupation. But that, to me, I'm troubled when I hear that kind of slogan, because it does seem a little bit simplistic and naive, and it fails to place the blame for this war where it squarely belongs, which is on Mr. Putin and on his government and forces.
I want to look inside Russia now, Ted, and some of the documents involved in this leak. Talk about divisions within the Russian government and military between the head of the Wagner group of mercenaries, the official army, the National Guard, intelligence services. Again, not a surprise. We knew some of this was going on. Did you see anything in this leaks that amplified some of those tensions?
Well, I will say, and so the conflict between Prigozhin, who, you know, directs the Wagner group, and the official Russian services, that's been well known and well documented. The, you know, the leaked documents maybe gave some nuance. I was, but one thing that I was a little bit more surprised by was the information about the documents show that there was a dispute or some contretemps between the intelligence services, the FSB, which is the successor to the KGB specifically, and then the armed forces, the Russian, you know, equivalent of the Department of Defense, the military, over reports on casualty numbers. And so that was something that again, it's not surprising, but it is interesting to hear, because that's gotten a lot less play in the Western media coverage and the, you know, the sort of think tanks and the Twitter observers who comment extensively on the war. And so it does, you know, it does appear that, you know, if anything, so we knew that there was conflict within the Russian sort of military elite, and one would expect such conflicts in the case of a war. Mm-hmm. And the leaked documents do confirm, if anything, maybe the conflict is even more extensive and more complex than we had previously known. So certainly, and that's, of course, from the perspective of, you know, an adversary of this war machine that Ukraine is facing, it's good news when you hear that the adversary has these kinds of conflicts and struggles. Now, whether or not that means that Russia is on the imminent brink of an internal coup or something like that is, of course, a much more questionable conclusion to reach. But it certainly is not good for the Russian war effort that they're having these kinds of disagreements and disputes and outright confrontations. I mean, Prigozhin, now there's signs that he's trying to take over a political party. So that is consistent with the reports that he may actually be aiming to be Mr. Putin's successor himself, which, of course, may or may not actually work. It's unlikely to actually work, but it certainly is another potential source of these kinds of conflicts and cleavages on the Russian side of really breaking out into the open and causing some kind of severe crisis within the Russian military establishment.
Time for one more caller. Austin is with us in Westby. Austin, hi.
Hi there. I had read a book several years ago called Vodka Politics that kind of documents the way that alcohol has been used as a mechanism for statecraft in Russia and the Soviet Union. And wondering if that's what the gentleman thinks are mechanisms that are being used to quell opposition to the war as of current.
Interesting question, Austin. Ted, in just our last minute, internal dissent in Russia, to the extent that it's there, how is it managed by the regime?
Well, I would say that vodka policy may have something to do with it, but it's really a third order or minor element. That the Russian government has really reached dramatic new heights beyond even what some of us who've been very skeptical and cynical about, or very critical of the Russian government's crackdown on its civil society and on civic freedoms in Russia, have expected. And so I would just note that, that Russia has become an all out and out full-fledged authoritarian country since the start of the war. It was moving well in that direction for the last decade or so. People are probably familiar with some of the relevant laws, such as the foreign agent law, the undesirable organizations law. But we've really seen an incredible extent of a crackdown on free speech. We cases and cases of people who are being not just prosecuted, but arrested, or not just arrested, but prosecuted and sent in jail for long sentences for posting very innocuous things on Facebook. Even their children in school sometimes are drawing the drawing saying, "I support peace," and it's arresting the parents getting put in jail. This is an outright authoritarian crackdown. Journalists have fled the country. All independent news outlets have been shut down, and most of their employees have actually fled Russia. We see an unprecedented, ever since the Soviet Union, unprecedented extent of a full-fledged coercive attack. And universities are losing faculty. They're in danger of shutting down. It's really, really extreme.
We'll have to leave it there. Thanks to our guest, Ted Gerber, professor of sociology at UW-Madison. Talked to us about the leak of classified U.S. intelligence documents, including some related to the war in Ukraine. Tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer-Kent, find out how to choose senior living and nursing home facilities. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up today at 6 on 1A+, it's been a while, but we now know who's going back to the moon. NASA has announced who the crew will be. They'll be traveling faster and farther than any human since the Apollo 17 mission launched in 1972. 1A Plus brings us a special feature, Ask an Astronaut. That's today at 6 here on the Ideas Network. Now, we spend the majority of our time in childhood around our immediate family, our parents, and our siblings, if any. Those relationships have a big influence on our development as we transition from childhood to teen years into our adult lives. A growing field of studies exploring the exact role that sibling relationships, or being an only child, can have on our personalities, our resilience, and our social dynamics. Our next guest is working on that research to help better understand how our families bond and how our bonds can make us who we are. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Whether you were an only child or came from a big crew, how do you think that affected your childhood? How did your siblings or lack of siblings shape the person you are today? Tell us your best sibling story at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Anna Lindell is an assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. Anna, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much, Rob. It's great to be here today.
All right. We have a lot of close relationships potentially in our lives. What is unique about a sibling relationship from your perspective as a psychologist?
Yeah, well, compared to all of the relationships that we have in our lifetime, siblings are, if we have siblings, they can be one of the longest lasting relationships that we have. There's a quote that I love that says that, well, our friends come and go, our parents eventually leave us, but our siblings are often the ones that we spend the majority of our lifespan with. And they're also kind of this quintessential love-hate relationship. So there are some very unique dynamics that we really don't see in any other close relationships that we have.
What are some of the big things you look for when it comes to how sibling relationships change over time, you know, from childhood through teen years and into adulthood?
Yeah, well, I think a lot of the things that really influence the way that sibling relationships change is we have to think about how people change as they move through childhood and adolescence and into adulthood. And we have different kind of developmental tasks that we're all working on during those times. And our siblings kind of follow along with us. And so if we're thinking about really young children who have a sibling, obviously, those two young children, they might spend a lot of time together, be very companionate with each other. But then as we start to get older, we start to maybe move away from our siblings a little bit and focus more on other relationships. So it can be pretty interesting to see the ways that those dynamics shift.
One assumption that I think was around for a long time, and if I understand correctly, research doesn't bear it out, is that there's something about only children, that not having siblings leads to certain personality traits, personality types, often over time viewed with suspicion. Is there anything at all to that, Anna?
Not in my current research. I would say that siblings, the way that we think about these relationships, they serve as an important support role for people. And if children are only children, they will ideally find that support in other relationships that they have. They might spend more time learning from their parents or from their peers, but if you have siblings, that can be a really rich source of socialization and support.
We are talking about siblings, our relationships with them, what they mean for our development as people. Anna Lindell is with us, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches this, and you can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have siblings, how has your relationship with them changed at different parts of your lives? Have they been an important part of your life? Join in at 800-642-1234. If you're an only child, do you wish you'd had siblings, as people might expect you to, or did you not see what the big deal was all about? 800-642-1234 is the number. Getting into how sibling relationships work, Anna, what are some of the characteristics of a strong, healthy sibling relationship?
Yeah, well, one of the unique things about sibling relationships is they are such a stable relationship that they can really withstand a lot and still end up okay in the end. So what we often look for in healthy sibling relationships, when children are younger, when they're in adolescence, we're looking for a lot of positive qualities. So are siblings spending a lot of time together, but is that time meaningful? Is there this expectation that that sibling will be there for them no matter what? Is there affection in that relationship? Is there nurturance in that relationship? Do siblings feel like they can trust and support one another? And even if siblings do have conflict, that's very typical. And it really just kind of shows how close those siblings are, because if we kind of think about the kinds of conflicts that children and adolescents have with their siblings, we're typically talking about squabbles that would come up just by virtue of being under the same roof. So that's not necessarily indicative of a poor sibling relationship. It's very expected and also provides a lot of training ground for how to resolve conflicts effectively.
When might a parent or someone look at a sibling relationship, maybe of their kids, and say, wait, this is above and beyond. This is not normal squabbles. This is actually something negative that we got to worry about.
Yeah, I think it comes down to looking at the balance between how frequently are those conflicts occurring, how intense are the conflicts. So if conflicts are very frequent, but also especially intense, without a whole lot of those other positive qualities going on, that could be a time where we might take a look at if there's something we can do to help maybe strengthen those relationships and maybe shift some of those relational qualities around a little bit. But frequent conflicts are not particularly problematic. We know that during late parts of middle childhood, early adolescence, siblings are going to fight. They're trying to assert their autonomy. They're trying to get their equal share. And so having frequent conflicts on their own, not particularly problematic in the long run.
For siblings who have had a difficult, maybe more than usual squabbling type of relationships as kids, What kind of things can they do as grownups when they've got some distance from that to reconnect and maybe confront and overcome those negative years?
Yeah, and there's actually been some research that we've done that's kind of looked at some of these changes after siblings do move apart from one another. So even if siblings maybe had pretty frequent conflicts when they were under one roof together during adolescence, we often find that having just some physical separation from their sibling can often be kind of a catalyst for restarting some of those relationships. And sometimes what we find is if siblings had a very negative relationship when they were living together, sometimes that might mean that those siblings do drift apart a little bit after they do separate, but sometimes it can also create a new opportunity to kind of rekindle that relationship, start to recognize what they value in that relationship once they've had a little bit of time to take a step back.
One thing I wonder about, my brother and I are about 5 years apart, and we were in different worlds as kids. We get along really well now. My daughters are twins, so they're minutes apart. Does the difference in age have a big bearing on how sibling relationships work?
Absolutely. So we absolutely find that siblings who are closer in age, they have a lot more overlap in shared activities that they enjoy. They're more likely to maybe share friend groups, share similar interests. They might attend the same schools even. And so we often find that those siblings tend to have closer relationships, also maybe more conflictive relationships. Whereas if we have siblings who are farther apart in age, we're often going to see maybe more of kind of like a junior parent type of relationship, at least when they're younger, because there is such a difference in maturity level and life experiences. And then those differences don't seem to make quite as much of a difference once we reach adulthood.
We're talking to UW-Whitewater psychology professor Anna Lindell about the way our siblings could shape our childhood and development and how those relationships change over the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have siblings? How have you stayed in touch over the years? Are you close friends, whether you are right next door to each other these days or live in different parts of the country or the world? Did having siblings make life easier or more difficult for you growing up? If you're an only child, same question. Did you think that was easier, harder, or it's just what it was? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Verrett. We continue our talk with Anna Lindell. She's a psychology professor at UW-Whitewater. She's with us today to talk about siblings and how having siblings or not having them can influence our development from being kids through our adult lives and the relationships that we have with them through the years. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you want to give a shout out to the brother or sister in your life, how your relationship has changed over time, how you stay in touch? Maybe even if you've moved apart geographically, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Jack is with us in Madison. Jack, hello.
Hey, Rob. Yeah. So this is a little more about, I guess, uncles and less my siblings, but I heard your guest talking about, I think it was twins or siblings who are closer in age earlier, and it reminded me of my Irish twin uncles who, looked almost identical. They were short, blonde, blue boys, and they were really close together. They don't look that way anymore, believe me, but those guys were always doing stuff together, and I think until my older uncle was going into first grade and my younger uncle into kindergarten, my younger uncle thought that they were in fact twins until my older uncle's first grade teacher came up to him and said, "Sorry, Paul, you and Tom are not twins," Paul being the younger of the two uncles. And so that always struck me.
That's a great family story, Jack. Thanks a lot for that at 800-642-1234. Very close in an earlier generation, Anna. Have we seen changes in the closeness of our sibling relationships over the generations?
That's an interesting question. And that's one that I think we would have to think more about in terms of what part in the lifespan we're talking about. So I think if we're thinking about maybe older adolescents, now we see a lot more reliance on peer relationships and friendships and spending a lot of time outside of the home context in among today's adolescents. And so I think we might see maybe siblings perhaps spending less time together among today's adolescents. We certainly see changes in how likely it is that siblings will see each other frequently once they reach adulthood, as we kind of have people spreading out geographically more than in the past. But it's an interesting question historically to think about how these have changed over time. Yeah.
Jack, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. As we talk about siblings, hoping you can answer some of the questions that our guest, Anna Lindell from UW-Whitewater, just brought up. Do you feel like it's easy to stay in touch with your siblings? Is it something you want to do? Do you get a lot of joy from being in contact with your siblings? Does it seem like we do less of that over time? And hey, parents out there, if you have stories of your kids and how they get along as siblings, let us know. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Anna, what kind of things are you focusing your research on right now when it comes to sibling relationships?
Yeah, well, for a long time, we really didn't have much of a sense of how siblings maintain their relationships once they're no longer living under the same roof. And so what my current research is trying to do is trying to figure out, well, how do siblings best stay in touch with one another? And what benefits can siblings have once they may no longer be spending as much time together? So I'm really particularly interested in how college-aged siblings maintain their relationships and how sometimes we forget that siblings can be a really important resource for students who have siblings, particularly if we're thinking about first-generation college students who may not have parents or many other family members who've gone through the college experience before. Siblings might be a particularly valuable source of information, source of support that might help mitigate some of the challenges that first-gen students often have.
Let's go back to our callers now. John is with us in Rhinelander. John, hi.
Hi. I'm hearing a lot of sunshine going on about siblings. I grew up in a family that was rife with alcoholism, violence, and sexual abuse, which you would think would draw siblings close together. I have four siblings. None of us have spoken to each other in probably 10 or 15 years. Two or three of us actually actively detest each other. I am kind of sad that that's how it ended up, but just another direction.
John, thank you so much for being willing to share that with us. And I'm sorry things went that way. John brings up something I was hoping to get to, Anna. Things don't always work well. There are families that are very dysfunctional and have bad things going on. What do you look for in those kinds of sibling relationships?
Yeah, and in situations like that, we often find that when families are experiencing significant levels of stress, especially chronic stress, we can find sibling relationships can kind of go one of two different ways. So there's been a good amount of research looking at divorce as one context that has found that sometimes siblings, in light of that major life stressor, sometimes it pulls siblings closer together, but in many cases, it does lead siblings to kind of separate from one another. And that's a lot of that has to do with the particular circumstances surrounding the events in the family, but a lot of it also has to do with how close the siblings were kind of in the first place. So sometimes if siblings were very close, they might lean on each other. In other cases, they may not see their siblings as a particularly valuable source of support. And so we can absolutely see some of those types of events leading to separation from siblings, more feelings of indifference towards siblings, feelings of antagonism and dislike of siblings. So we can absolutely see it going either direction. Yes.
Thanks a lot for that call. Talking to Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater. She researches, among other things, sibling relationships, what they mean for us as we develop from kids into adults. Back to your calls now. Jim is with us in Madison. Jim, hi.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. What did you want to tell us about, Jim?
Well, what I want to tell you is I come from a large family. There was nine of us. We're nine within 14 years, but we're all in our 60s and 70s now. We're all different, yet we're very close. You know, it could be if somebody from the old neighborhood died or passed away or moved someplace, I could go be away from my phone for an hour and come back, and it's like a pack of firecrackers going off in my pocket because there's so many texts going back and forth.
And Jim, do you live? Do the nine of you live all over the country now, or are you mostly here in Wisconsin? How does that affect things?
Mostly in the Midwest. You know, if there's a gathering, we probably get together, I don't know, 3 to 5, 6 times a year. And if there's a gathering, it's, you know, there's probably 7 of us that show up anyway.
Interesting. Jim, thanks a lot for sharing that. Glad you're still in touch with everybody. A big group of siblings there, Anna.
Yeah, and I love that sibling context that the caller described, because what we often find is, especially once people kind of get into past the early part of adulthood, we often find siblings rekindling those relationships again, and they can be a great source of support and companionship. And it's almost like they pick up right where they left off, despite all of the busyness that we often get in earlier parts of adulthood. We absolutely find siblings maintaining those close relationships. And today it's even easier than ever to keep those ties close with all the forms of technology that we have. It's really exciting.
Jim, thanks for that call. Susie is with us now in New Berlin. Susie, hi.
Hi. My parents considered it extremely important for us to get along, the four of us kids. I'm number 3 out of the 4 within 5 years, and we're in that time zone where everybody just had a pile of kids all at once. Anyway, we passed that on to our children. I had 2 little kids. When they were little, if they argued with each other, and they got along real well most of the time, but if they got into an argument and I had enough of it, then I would say, all right, you two, hold hands, look at each other in the eye, and you have to say 2 things about each other that you really like, but it can't have anything to do with how they look. And so they'd have to stand there until they could actually say the 2 things, and it was always so cute. But they only got to do it a couple of times because after they realized that I was serious about this and I was going to keep doing it, they started arguing. I'd come in the room, they'd go, oh, wait, don't argue, because Mama's here. She's going to make us do that again. And so they didn't have to do it very often, but they're 39 and 36 and a half, and still very, very dear friends, even though one lives in Tulsa and the other one lives in Washington State.
Susie, thanks a lot for sharing that. Anna, whether it's Susie's example or something else, are there things that parents can do to help cultivate happy relationships among their kids?
Yeah, and especially thinking about how parents can kind of foster those positive sibling relationships, we absolutely find that parents should celebrate and acknowledge their children's differences among one another. Some of the callers have mentioned how they're very different, but also very similar. And I think that parents really should work very hard not to compare their children with one another, and really kind of acknowledge what makes each of their children unique, because then that'll reduce the possibility of sibling rivalry. Siblings will feel less like their parents are treating them unfairly compared to their sibling. And I think doing whatever parents can do to encourage those positive relationships, spending time with each other as a family, but also giving them their own space and autonomy as well.
And thanks for that call. And just at our last minute, Anna, she mentioned she was the, I think, 3rd of 4. Another popular psychology thing, birth order matters. If you're the 1st kid or the 7th kid or whatever, it affects your personality. Just like some of the only childhood stuff, does research bear that out?
Not so much. Sometimes we might find that firstborn being a little bit more independent. But I think a big difference is the way that parents treat their children. So sometimes parents treat the first child as a first draft, and then they think about their younger children, and they learn from their experiences with their older ones. So there might be a little bit of truth to it, but not as much as we might think.
Anna, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you so much. It was a pleasure.
That's Anna Lindell, assistant professor of psychology at UW-Whitewater, where she researches child development and the role that parent and sibling relationships play in healthy development. She was with us today to talk about the role that having siblings or being an only child plays in our development over the years. Still time for you to share your own story, if you'd like, over on the Ideas Network Facebook page, or just give a shout out to a sibling, or you can email ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time: what makes a good apology and what makes a bad one? Sometimes it's harder than you think to make amends. We'll get some great advice on the topic with the authors of a new book called Sorry, Sorry, Sorry. Ann. It's this week's edition of Food Friday with a family that cooks Chinese food together. They share their secrets with us in the new cookbook, The Woks of Life. That's tomorrow on Central Time.